Monday. What day is
April 8th. Today is Saturday when we're recording this.
Monday, April 8th.
The episode is coming out April 8th.
It's LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. We have Alyssa Walker and Hayes Davenport back in LA.
Back in LA. Boy.
People were terrified that you were actually leaving the show when I said you were. I made that joke.
I do think, and I told some people this while I was there, Vancouver is a very interesting place. Somebody should do Vancouver podcasts. A lot of the stuff that we are dealing with here, they're dealing with in a much crazier way. That is the least affordable city, I think, in.
But they've also solved a lot of problems that we.
Such as?
They don't have Uber and Lyft.
That is
true. They have a lot more family housing.
That. It's easy. You walk out on the street and you can actually call a cab.
Car ownership has dropped by, it's less than half.
But. And it's really walkable. It's like just a gorgeous city in general. But for whomst?
Well.
Alyssa will tell you.
Families.
Really rich families. It is really, really expensive. They haven't figured out the affordability component. That's really the last thing left. It is a wonderful place, but just really, really expensive. We have a lot to get into today. Anyone have good LA stories? Anyone? No one.
I went to Home State today, and after the
it's the most cited restaurant on this podcast, well, for
gonna,
sure.
I was gonna say after the very public haranguing I got after we talked about the tortillas.
So that's so
last
funny.
Time.
I felt like I was the one who was harangued.
Well, maybe we both were, but I went back with the intention of trying these world's best flour.
The conversation
tortillas.
Was you said that there is no circumstance under which you would prefer a flour tortilla to a corn tortilla.
For a taco.
Yes. And now I'm interested. For like a burrito, you would prefer
yes.
a flour tortilla?
Because okay. I'm not a monster.
How would you do that?
Well, that's
giant corn tortillas.
And I was making the case that at Home State, the flour tortillas are great and the corn tortillas are not clearly secondary. Even on the menu, they're like in-house made flour tortillas. Please get these.
Okay. And I was saying, and here's the follow-up to that previous LA story.
Yeah.
I concede nothing. Flour tortillas are not better.
They're so much better.
They may brand it however they want. They're not better. Please stay out of my DMs and my replies on Twitter. I don't want to hear about it.
I'll talk about how I was so kind of excited and nervous the whole time I was in Vancouver that when I got back, I would be too late to see the baby geese at Echo Park Lake. Every time, late March, early April is hashtag geezy season in, at the lake. That's when the babies show up. And I could see from Vancouver, the Canada geese
right.
heading south down to Echo Park Lake to have these babies. And I was worried that I was going to miss it.
Right.
And so the first full day after I came back, I went straight to the lake and I was rewarded so generously by, I saw 13 baby geese, and you can just tell that there are more coming. It's going to be a big season.
I really hope that the geezy season joke was worth it, because now Kanye will pay Kim Kardashian $1 million not to mention our podcast on any social media app, just by virtue of you having done that.
That's you got to check them out, because they get kind of gross. They become gross geese teens pretty soon. They get very gawky and weird looking. Now they're like peeps. They look like right. actual peeps, Alyssa. Yeah.
Gray peeps, though.
No, they're not gray. I sent you guys video. Do you not watch my geese videos?
They're yellow.
Yellow. They are Easter yellow classic peeps.
I don't watch your geese content.
Unbelievable.
I'm sorry.
I sent you a personal
also,
video.
They're still yellow. They're yes. not gray yet.
No, they are fully yellow. They're like the classic peeps. Isn't it your big thing that you accept?
Goslings were gray in the book.
Unless these geese like adopted baby.
I think ducks are
chickens.
Ducks are yellow.
These were definitely geese babies. I yes, encourage you to watch all my videos
I
that I send you
before they went, you know, too mainstream.
You're not a peeps person anymore. It's not as much a part of your identity
not,
as it used to be.
It's not just about peeps. It's like about all these other products that they make now with the peeps. Like they have like creamer for your coffee.
Ew.
And
that's disgusting.
Yeah, it's too much.
What, you have any LA stories from this week?
I have an LA story from 5 years ago.
That is okay.
Launched
sort of testing
it.
The limits. of relevance.
Five years ago.
So a friend of mine, an architect, recently died this week, Francois Perrin, who was an amazing, not just an architect, did very experimental, cool things with architecture, but also just was a curator. And through these happenings is the best way to call it. He was French. So I think it's like brought a level of cool to the city and to the design scene that we had not had before. And I just wanted to go over this one event, which was like the most amazing LA moment I've ever had. It was an installation that he did with a few other artists, one of them being the singer from Air, the French band, electronic band Air, at the Sheets Goldstein house. And if you don't know what house that is, you will know it as Jackie Treehorn's house from the Big Lebowski.
Of course.
Up in the hills, like a Beverly Crestish hills, very distinctive John Lautner modern home with like this amazing triangular rooftop and this pool and no like railings anywhere. It's like super dangerous to have like hundreds of people up and serve them alcohol, but people do it all the time. And it's owned by James Goldstein, who you also know, even if you don't know who he is.
The Rhinestone Cowboy.
He's sitting in the front row of every Lakers game or the floor or whatever, wearing these like amazing get-ups with a cowboy hat of all different colors. And so he has all different outfits, not just the same like rainbow cowboy hat. So Francois made this incredible cultural moment by installing all these site-specific artwork. Some of them reference the architect of the house, John Lautner. Some of them reference like Jim Goldstein himself. There was like, you know, self-portraits and stuff of like him. And then had all these people come to this party and see this house. And we were with, it was like everybody was there from the architecture and design community. And I just remember like standing on the pool deck and like looking out over the city, and it was kind of like that gloomy mid April night, and you know there's a sculpture over in the distance of John Lautner, and I'm standing next to Giorgio Moroder. And it was
that's
Daft who you Punk, would hear in your head that's the, while yeah, you're
it was,
out
and
there.
That was that week that like that Daft Punk song came out that I'm not gonna sing like Scott like last week, but you know the Get Lucky that he was on that album.
I was
just standing there being like, do I really live here? Is this really like my life? And are these really, you know, I'm sharing all this incredible moment with all these people. And I just want to thank Francois, who is surfing in somewhere now, not with us, for making that happen. And, you know, really, really making that quintessential LA moment that, you know, I think about all the time.
And you wrote something great about him.
I did. I wrote a little story on Curbed to remember him. So he's doing that. He was working on an installation for the Schindler House. Mm-hmm. He did all these installations at like famous houses, I guess. So he's working on something for the Schindler House that might be installed later. He wasn't able to finish it before he died. So look for that soon. I'll have another.
Cool.
I hope Giorgio Moroder will come to that one too.
Oh my God. Did you recognize him on site?
Somebody like had said he was there, and that I didn't really put it all together till later.
If you couldn't tell, we are in Alyssa's garage again. You can hear somehow the choppers are way more intense.
That was part
here.
Of my quintessential LA moment. Oh yeah. It came over at that time.
We wanted to. So Scott, you introduced a segment last week, called Cite Your Sources. An article came out this week that I think if we don't cite the sources on this one, this Bloomberg article, even do the segment? The segment was built for this article. And so we do want to play the theme song.
All right. So here we go. So it goes, C is for when you... Oh my God, I immediately forgot the words.
It's okay.
I is for, and I don't believe a word. T is tell me really, where did you get this shit from? E is even more than anything I could stand for. And cite your sources for me, please.
That was from memory. It seems like that's like the first time doing the song that you decided to do it from memory is very brave, and I'm not sure it paid off.
No, it did not. Well, I mean, it did give you and Alyssa so much joy, I
and
think.
And it continues to. So the article that came out, it's in Bloomberg Opinion, we should say. And the headline is Los Angeles is having a loud economic boom. It's by Matthew Winkler. And the subhead is From Home Values to Share Prices. Its expansion is outpacing big city peers under a business-friendly Democratic mayor. It's not necessarily that anything in this article is untrue, But the idea that LA is having an economic boom, I don't think tells the complete picture necessarily.
Right.
The article says that measured by growth of personal income, gross domestic product per capita, jobs, home prices, global trade and transportation, corporate equity, and municipal debt, Los Angeles has become the most productive of the five biggest U.S. cities. Even its perennial calamity of homelessness receded significantly for the first time since last year.
Yes, that is
you can interrupt me and definite, say cite your sources.
That's a definite citation needed there. I think we've talked about the homelessness issue since we started this show.
Yes.
And first of all, I think the numbers that have been coming out from the city don't back up that the problem has receded significantly. I think what we've seen is it surged an enormous amount and then it sort of leveled off. Mm-hmm. But even having said that, we just talked about a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, the fact that the way that we handle this count is basically designed to get a bare minimum yep. of the people who are actually homeless on our streets.
Yes.
But homelessness is not mentioned in this story.
It's only in that context.
Yeah, it's
only
like, it's not
something,
you,
a problem
you kept
that is,
waiting
that is
for
going
like
away.
The only butt it, of the yeah, it's a, story.
It brought up so that it could be dismissed.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
The article says Garcetti didn't set off the LA boom, but there's no doubt that the city has prospered under his leadership. The thesis of the piece.
Well, I mean, cite that. I mean, have we?
There is a chart.
There's a chart.
There's a chart. And
it shows the line. Yeah. It's a line graph like of the city's GDP per capita, and it's, you know, declines in 2008 and it starts kind of gradually going up again. And then once Garcetti shows up in City Hall, there is a somewhat steeper climb for while he is in office.
Okay, but I think we should, the thing that I think is frequently confused or confusing in these conversations is that the GDP is a measure, it's a good measure of the size of an economy. Mm-hmm. So it's not like useless to say that our GDP per capita has been growing faster than other large cities in America. But I do think that it is somewhat harder to try and claim that because GDP per capita is rising faster than peer cities, that in some way that is like being experienced by anybody who lives here.
Yes.
Like that's not clear at all to me.
No. And that's not really delivered on in the article. The focus is on how much corporations have benefited that are based here and trade uh-huh, through here. Right. He talks a lot about the mayor is quoted extensively in it. I mean, I would sort of hope that if the mayor were going to participate in an article like this, he would want to the people to understand the challenges that the people who live here still face. But he talks a lot about public-private partnerships, specifically related to the Olympics. They raised $50 million in 2 weeks from corporate Los Angeles. The $14 billion increase to increase passenger airline traffic in the next few years. Things that are not necessarily going to affect the vast majority of people that live in the city. There are a couple of choice quotes in here. The mayor says that he never met a CEO he didn't like. He says that LA is a place that doesn't say no and has more success than not in leading our future.
The mayor is the only person quoted in this story.
Yeah, that's
the
true.
Only person.
That's true.
And it is kind of a press piece for him, it seems like.
Well, my theory is that they pre-wrote this when they thought he was going to be running for president, and then they're like, oh, well, what do we do with,
do
what do we do with
this?
All this now?
I mean, I would say that I actually, to a certain extent, agree with Garcetti that under him, LA is a city that doesn't say no if you are a very wealthy person or corporation coming here looking for whatever.
Mm.
Olympics, you know, we famously went after that twice.
Well, this story presents a very interesting perspective of that. In my first hour of on the job, the first thing I did was write a letter to the United States Olympic Committee.
Yeah.
Did we know that? Did we know that it was his literal first order of business?
I don't think so.
And we did not get it. And then we went after it again after Boston.
I don't know if it's a silly point. He says LA has bid on the Olympics more than any other city in the world.
Yeah, also,
like most shots is not like a good statistic in any sport.
The Lucas Museum, we sought that out.
Sought that fail.
Did not get it.
But then,
and then went back at it again.
Yep, so, as an afterthought.
I guess more accurate would be to say
LA, we get things that no one else wants.
LA is, LA is the city that after you've already said no thanks.
After three other cities already say no, we'll take it.
We will be there.
I wonder, is HQ2 inevitably coming soon?
That was my big fear when I heard that it wasn't going to New York, was that Garcetti would burst through the wall.
So he says, when I think about LA, what we have, of course, is infrastructure. We could do the Olympics every 4 years and make money off of it. And we expect to net north of $1 billion. I mean, is this going to happen? Yeah. No other city in the world
to be announced
wants this.
I actually would love to see sources cited on the expectation to make $1 billion. I don't think I've seen that anywhere.
I haven't. That's the first mention I've seen of that too. Break even I've seen is like people trotting that out. We won't lose money.
Like modest profit.
Yeah.
Like maybe $10-20 million. Not $1 billion.
That's the first time I've seen that number, and I've written about this for a long time.
It feels like he must have a financial stake in No Olympics memes. Like he gets paid every time they use like a Getty image of him or something. Like that's the only explanation for how kind of brazen these quotes are. This is related to a couple other things that came out this week. There was an article by Alyssa's colleague, Elijah Chiland, in Curbed, where he talked about a study by the real estate analyst Black Knight that shows that LA has the highest tappable equity in terms of home value in the country. The value of homes that owners have access to at any given time. You might think it would be close to like a city like New York, which is sort of famous for very high home values. LA homeowners have nearly double the equity of New York, double the home values, and more than double the entire state of Texas. This is the LA metro area, which is highly populated, but it's not even close to as big as Texas and definitely not twice as big.
Yeah.
What does it mean that our total home value, which about half of Angelenos have access to, that's wealth held by about half of the population. What does it mean that it is so much bigger than places like New York City and the entire state of Texas?
What does it mean, like in terms of the mechanics of that, or what does it mean for people who live here?
Why is it so
it's
much?
It's the
higher
gap between how much the land is worth and how many people are able to draw equity from that land. Like, really, I would think that is the vast majority of the story here. And certainly the difference between here and a place like New York is that, I mean, imagine if the island of Manhattan, which couldn't function economically if this were the case, was covered still the way it was in the like 1800s with like mansions and, mm-hmm. and things like that, that were property and province of single family landowners. Mm-hmm. Like, we give over land that is unconscionably valuable to these very few, like small number of people who live here. The demand is exceedingly high. It will always be probably higher than the number of people who live here, but the disparity is so great, and also like the equity that these people have in their homes is probably total in most cases. I would say in a lot of cases these are people who have been in one place for decades and just, you know, own their land free and clear and pay very little taxes on it, and it's an enormous benefit to be a homeowner in such a situation.
Related to this, did you guys see that, of course, you know, the president was in town the last couple of days. You didn't notice?
Yep.
He went, there was a fundraiser at Beverly Hills. He was in Calexico at the border for a little while, but then he took Marine One, the helicopter, down to Trump National Golf Club in Rancho Palos Verdes.
So why was the 405 closed then? Oh, no, he went to a fundraiser.
He
okay,
did
never
go
mind.
To a fundraiser
okay,
in Beverly mind. Hills, yes. I was very curious to see if prodigal House candidate Omar Navarro was going to be invited to Trump National Golf Club, where he has paid for many campaign events.
Right.
And so I checked his Twitter account to find him begging to be invited still at 6 p.m. last night. It was so funny. Anyway, there was a story that came out earlier this week. I don't know if you guys saw that the Trump Organization was delinquent in paying the property taxes on Trump National Golf Club.
I did not see this.
On two parcels of land totaling 25 acres. And they hadn't paid the annual property tax on that property in Rancho Palos Verdes. And the property tax was $36,000.
That's such a shocker.
Like 25 football fields.
Right.
On the ocean, yeah. Overlooking the ocean. That's an assessed valuation. The implied valuation of a $36,000 property tax is that property is worth $3.6 million.
Yeah.
When it's worth probably 10 times more. I mean,
at least.
Could you get $50 million for that?
For that
chunk of land?
Oh my God. I would assume it would be more.
I guess it probably
is. Doesn't
the
Trump brand like knock it down a few mil?
Yeah, but you can pull those letters right out when you buy it.
So the club is struggling a lot. Like people have gone, like people do not in Southern California do not really patronize this golf club. It's public, meaning that everyone can play, but I think it's like $300 a round or something like that. But why not just hang on to it when you're only paying $36,000 a year in property tax and just let it accumulate? I mean, what an incredible asset that is to just sit on. And then like sell to a developer like somewhere down the line and just make insane profit. He bought in 2002. So that shows like under Prop 13 how much the value has exploded over that time.
Yeah, that is really
$36,000.
The only part of that story that's not surprising is that he's not paying it. I mean,
right?
That's the only part that surprises me not at all.
Let's talk about, so after our record last week, we recorded on Sunday, and on Sunday night was the fatal shooting of Nipsey Hussle. This is a story that has obviously gotten a lot of coverage, but he was someone who was so vital to South LA, particularly Slauson and like Crenshaw. Let's talk a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so I think that this story has, I've kind of been surprised by the amount of coverage that this has gotten locally and nationally. Of course, Nipsey Hussle was best known in a national context as a rapper, as somebody who was like deeply involved in the LA rap scene, good friends with like The Game and YG, people that are enormous and influential figures in LA music. Nipsey Hussle had been coming up for a number of years and was, I think, kind of just like perceived as being at this breakthrough moment in his career. That's mm-hmm. That's kind of like the one half of the story of who he was. I think if you And actually a lot of politicians did this, a lot of newspapers did this. If you actually talk to him, he would tell you first and foremost, he considered himself to be somebody who was a representative of the community that he grew up in, and that he put it on himself to kind of like return anything that came his way in terms of resources and connections and things like that back into the community that he felt had raised him. In a way that he didn't feel like those resources were there for him when he was a kid, in a way that he felt like had been generally denied to the Crenshaw community. So what happened last week, we're talking about April 1st, is that right? Or March 31st? March 31st. In the parking lot of the clothing store that he owned, Nipsey Hussle and two others were exiting his clothing store and were approached by a man that was known to him. Eric Holder is his name. And after potentially some kind of verbal disagreement, either that they had had earlier that day or previously, this man fired off a bunch of shots and shot Nipsey six times. He eventually died later that evening. And I believe that the other two people that he was with were hit but survived.
Yes.
So Eric Holder was eventually arrested later this week. He's being held on like a multi-million-dollar bail for premeditated murder. This has kind of, I think, shaken a lot of people in L.A. and beyond. But particularly in L.A., I think, and I'd be interested in hearing what you guys think, this has, I think, really exposed, from the journalistic side of things, I think it's exposed a lot of what, I don't even know how else to say this, but like the lacuna of like coverage of what social issues are in South LA and the extent to which a lot of these things go unremarked on until something very tragic happens out in the open. And then there's a lot of a discussion about what it means, but it is not from, it's not from a place of having followed the through lines throughout.
Right. Well, I think a lot of organizations are sort of holding back when it comes to like what this represents, because there is no known motive for the shooting at this point. Right. And while Nipsey Hussle was like an active gang member a long time ago, it's not understood to be something that he was like still involved in. Like there were some news organizations that connected this to like called this a gang shooting basically, and talked about how this was like an extra violent week in South LA.
Right. Actually, the chief of police did that. Michael Moore went in his press conference and was him and Garcetti, who have been publicly all over this in a way that I personally have found extraordinarily garish.
Everyone sort of showed up to claim him.
Yeah.
And not just them, also Steve Soboroff, the head of the police commission.
Yeah.
Talked about how he was supposed to meet with Nipsey Hussle for like a collaborate LAPD Nipsey collab that they were like supposedly working on that didn't. It sounded like something that Nipsey Hussle would have appreciated the chance to like clarify exactly what it was.
Yeah, I've mentioned in the past that I've seen Steve Soboroff speak publicly before, and it's quite an experience. It's interesting make sense of the things that he's saying. But I really do feel like the comments that were being made, like you said, were the kind of things that any person, particularly anybody who was a social activist, would be kind of like, wait, you're sort of misrepresenting everything. Like, and it's unfortunate to see that happen when the person can't be there to actually speak in their own defense afterwards. But yeah, so Michael Moore and Eric Garcetti use this as an opportunity to talk about the rise in shootings and in South LA. Alyssa, I think you had pulled some quote from them where they were talking about how like all of a sudden crime is going up. There's like a surge or whatever. And
well, yeah, they had just had a press conference not too long ago where they celebrated the decline in violent crime.
Yeah.
It was weeks ago.
Yeah. The state of the city.
I think. Or it was, they just, you know, they had this like, we're talking about crime, and it was just so interesting that all of a sudden now there's a violent crime spree, and I don't know what they decided they're going to do about it, but it was just so part of trying to tie it to this, like you said, like trying to associate that with this or using it as a way to talk about, oh, well now we have to get tough on crime. Violent crime is way up again or something. It was weird also that the mayor confirmed the death to the media, which was
right.
I can't think of like another celebrity or somebody dying recently where like the mayor was the one to AP.
That's right.
Confirming the death. It was very, that was very strange. As someone who, you know, when you cover these things.
Or at least the mayor's office, right?
Yeah, or
was
it? Well, it actually said Mayor Eric Garcetti confirms. And I don't, it was just, it was all just very strange. Yeah. To kind of, you know, I'm saying like the same thing. I think we're all kind of saying the same thing. It was like using this death in a way to make certain points about whatever they wanted to make a point about that week.
There was a politician who did talk about his affiliation with Nipsey Hussle in a much more appropriate way, which was Councilmember Marquise Harris Dawson talked about Nipsey Hussle's involvement in Destination Crenshaw, which is a new project. They call it an open air museum that's planned for Crenshaw Boulevard right along the Crenshaw Line light rail that's currently under construction. Kind of a response to what the neighborhood felt like was an insult, which is the fact that the light rail does not go over underground. It's at grade, meaning it goes right along the ground in that neighborhood, which people in that neighborhood didn't really want.
Yeah.
So they're turning it into like kind of a response. It's kind of like a cultural celebration.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be finished by the end of this year. And he was very involved.
Really involved. Yes.
Yeah. He was, you know, they had this great outreach team and they had advisors, and that will be a great, you know, testament to his legacy. I think it's a good thing to draw his name into that, because he was actually involved.
He went on DNA, Francis Anderton's KCRW show this week, Marquise Harris Dawson, and talked about how the logo for the project was designed by Nipsey's team that did stuff for the Marathon store. Yeah. That whole Crenshaw logo that they designed has really gotten around. So that was a cool thing. And I'm
I think Destination Crenshaw is a really, really cool project. And it's one that people have asked me in the past, you know, if we were going to talk about it when it first debuted. It's a fully open air museum. It's kind of like, I think that people really saw it as the people that were involved in putting it together, Nipsey Hussle among them, saw it as this opportunity to showcase their neighborhood, to showcase Crenshaw, to showcase Hyde Park, to showcase these historically black parts of LA. Of course, we've talked about here the footprint of what you could actually consider black Los Angeles has dramatically diminished over the course of the past several decades. These are still corridors that are predominantly black neighborhoods with commercial strips where there are actually black owned businesses, which is a rarity these days in Los Angeles. And to really like put forward this multi-partite celebration of black history and art is something that people thought was a great way to respond in a positive way to, I think, what is perceived by many people as the sort of coming in of gentrification and gentrifying forces. The train is one of those, but I think also you could make an argument that area has been gentrifying for some time before that. So Destination Crenshaw sort of takes that and just is like placing this marker. I think I've heard a lot of people talk about it as a response to, like you said, Hayes, a response to an insult. But I think also there's so much positivity in that, like just sort of, it's sort of
turning it into something positive.
Self-description of like who and what Black LA is, like why is it important? Turning it into something that can really be celebrated by anybody who comes to and through the neighborhood and making it accessible in a way that I think that Los Angeles is frequently not accessible to people. If you are mm-hmm. not from a particular area in LA, I think I personally experience this going to other areas, other parts of town feels somewhat inaccessible or just illegible generally.
And I also think that Metro Rail doesn't do a very good job of that anywhere else really in the city. I mean, there are some great public art pieces and there's some like things like the Chinatown Gold Line Station, which is, you know, a pagoda, which is kind of weird, but also, I don't know, maybe in line with the architecture. But there isn't this kind of like interpretive infrastructure for when you go to different neighborhoods or even like anything that's to signify that you're, I guess the Hollywood and Vine station maybe does a good job.
If there's any other part of his legacy that would be nice to kind of live on, he had this idea. There's so much kind of conflict over in neighborhoods like South LA. Do you like develop those areas and like risk their like the property value rising and people having to move out and getting evicted? Or do you sort of leave them alone and risk disinvestment? And he just kind of had this idea of inclusive development. He bought the strip mall where the Marathon store was in and has plans that I assume are still active to turn it into a mixed use, like residential and retail complex with low income units, jobs for people that live in the neighborhood, like this kind of conscious development that's kind of a middle road that that would be great for the entire city, frankly, to try and replicate. We should talk about this Ninth Circuit ruling. This is something that they have ruled on before, but the Ninth Circuit saw a case related to whether people can be prosecuted for sleeping outside in a major city if there's lacking shelter access. The case that they were actually ruling on was in Boise. Notice that I did pronounce that correctly, and most people say Boise.
I'm going to keep saying Boise if it's okay.
Yeah, everyone
is.
I'm also going to say Boise.
Everyone is. But it applies to every Western state, and they basically ruled that it is unconstitutional to prosecute people for sleeping outside if there isn't adequate shelter in the city. And this seems like kind of a referendum on something that LA is debating a lot back and forth right now, which is the mayor has expressed a willingness to arrest people for sleeping on the street. especially in the neighborhoods of these abridged home developments that, right. that he is putting up, these shelters that we talked about last week, temporary housing for people trying to get to live in places. So does this case block those efforts? Like, does it make it impossible for them to arrest people for sleeping on the street? Or are they going to say, well, we've built all this shelter housing and there's still a couple empty beds, so if people don't go sleep in them, they get arrested?
Well, that, I mean, I guess it really depends on whether or not, when we're saying are there alternatives, do we mean on a case by case basis, or are they looking more at the systematic approach that the city has taken? I would assume that they're not going to be able to do this. Of course, it would probably have to be taken up in court. Again, I'm sure right. if the city does pursue this, which they've been kind of waffling about, then they would need to be willing to defend it in court. But we know for a fact that there are not enough bridge home, bridge shelter rooms to house all of the people in these neighborhoods that would need them.
So there's, right. there's two things too there. Well, we have, you know, we have a law that says you cannot sleep on the sidewalk, but we are not enforcing it because of our own agreement we right. made with the ACLU in 2007 or something like that, where they say, you know, it's the same basic rule. And the ACLU has been very vocal with this ruling as well about what that actually means, available beds and also accessible beds. So if you don't have a family, you don't have like a family unit for someone, or if you don't have a family unit, or you don't have someone has a disability or uses yeah. a wheelchair, these are all different accessibility issues that sometimes you don't actually right. have. You don't have the right shelter even for the right person.
Or even someone with a dog.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the pets thing is a huge thing. And yeah. there's a lot of conversations about that too. I think the interesting thing about this particular case and how it will be interpreted, because, you know, when you look at how all these different cities and even the city of Boise kind of fought back, you know, yeah. said that this doesn't yeah. mean that we can't, you know, this doesn't mean we can't actually not arrest people or whatever for sleeping on the street. It means that we will continue to litigate this to figure out what it actually means.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that is the immediate impact for cities. I mean, particularly cities that are not, that don't have more progressive leadership. And I would include LA in that. But I think that, what this really says to me is that the criminalization of homelessness is not really a worthwhile endeavor. Even it's not useful to try and enforce your way out of homelessness. I think it makes much more sense to spend those resources trying to develop a comprehensive set of solutions and like housing units that people can actually live in than to actually spend the time and money attempting to be punitive or, you know, provide the stick, as opposed to actually making it possible for people to get off the street.
And a lot of the advocates who talked about this ruling said the same thing. It's cheaper for a city to just provide housing. You should do that instead of sending people to the emergency room and enforcement. But let's look also at how well our solutions are being implemented. It's the 1 year anniversary this week of the Bridge Home program being announced. We were supposed to have right. 6,000 people housed in bridge housing projects within a year.
1,500 beds, he said, which could support 6,000 residents per year. I do want to say this was on April 17th of 2018.
Okay, so we've theoretically, got a week.
And we have, he has a week
he
to
has
get
a
up
week
to 1,500
to get
beds.
1,500
what
beds.
What are we at now?
We have one open in by Union Station yeah. and one just opened in Hollywood.
And that has how many beds?
Let's look real fast.
There's really no accountability for these timelines at all. And it's kind of, it's expected, but it still is very frustrating.
The Hollywood location has 72 beds and the downtown location has how many?
It looks like 44.
44. Okay. So we are at 116.
Oh wait, no, 44 is the settlers that came to the Pueblo. Hold on.
Well, what better way to honor them?
No, wait, it is 45.
Wow. In memoriam.
Okay, so to celebrate the people who originally settled in the Pueblo, 45. Okay, so we have 45 beds downtown.
72 in Hollywood, so that's 117 total out of 1,500. So we have a week left, you said?
We have a week left. I think we can do this.
So only like a little under 1,400 beds to house 6,000 people.
I think we can do it.
In one week from today.
And then they can decide what the radius, the appropriate radius is around that shelter to enforce people not being allowed to sleep around it
right.
because they obviously have no place to go because yes. it's probably full.
Okay, so we're going to talk. Let's talk about what Alex Villanueva got up to this week. He was so busy once again. And we should say we're recording this on Saturday. At the time of this recording, he has reinstated five more fired deputies in the past week. Who know what he?
Yeah, just at the rate he's going, there's got to be at least a few
more. And that was
more.
At the beginning of this recording. Yeah, so statistically, he's
probably
at least considering pulling the trigger on one more as we've been recording this. It's interesting. So two of them, Michael Cordial was one deputy who was accused of assaulting a suspect after the suspect was handcuffed, breaking the suspect's skull, causing a brain injury, and just sort of just repeatedly punching him, kicking him while he was down. Is that correct? And kicking his car?
Yeah, there's something about a car, but I don't. Or did somebody push him against the car? I'm not sure.
That's the only guy who we know what he was fired for at this point. He and another deputy were reinstated after a settlement agreement, I did air quotes, with the sheriff's department. I have no idea what that entails. They pay the sheriff's department? Like, what could that possibly mean?
Yeah, I have no idea, actually.
I looked up these like settlement agreements with the sheriff's department. I have no clarity on what a settlement agreement involves. You like what?
How often does this even happen? It seems like this is...
So that the sheriff's department actually overturning these things on their own is exceedingly rare, as the county supervisors are letting us know now that this is not normal. Essentially, what is somewhat more normal is the three other deputies were reinstated by the Civil Service Commission.
Right. Okay.
The Civil Service Commission, their website has not been updated since 2015. Every single member listed on the website is no longer serving as a commissioner. But what they are is a group of very lightly paid local lawyers and other upstanding citizens who review appeal cases for fired county employees. In recent years, the county, specifically, the supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas has moved to change Civil Service Commission operations. There was an article about this in the LA Daily News in 2016, because he basically says that they just get reports from county people saying what they should do, whether they should reinstate somebody or not. And they just kind of do it. So with a sheriff who seems very willing to put like just throwing out badges to anyone who wants to get theirs back.
Yep.
It seems like the Civil Service Commission would be potentially more amenable to putting some of these fired sheriffs back in office.
I really would love to
go back in time.
I would love to play the clip that Alex Villanueva shared on his own Twitter feed. Did you realize he's not verified? He's not a verified.
What? I didn't even know he had an account.
The LA County Sheriff account.
Oh, that account.
Not verified.
That's right. He took it over. What was the clip that he shared?
I would love to just listen to this. If you go to his Twitter.
He did a bunch of interviews this week. So this one is about is on KTLA 5, and it is about Michael Cordial.
I just want to give a shout out to the anchor here for having the exact same reaction that I have.
I know exactly what this is. Okay. I love it.
And there's one more bit of controversy involving the reinstatement of another deputy who's accused of misconduct. This one is Deputy Michael Cordial. Can you address the controversy involving that?
Actually, that entire process started in McDonald's administration. The county council had the case, they had concerns about it when the discharge was done last year. And John Benedict, who was an executive under the McDonald administration, he had concerns about it too, and he brought to the attention of his successor, who is Chief Dennis Neer. And he took the matter to county council. They assessed the situation. They realized they could not sustain that discharge in civil service, because there was fatal errors in the actual investigation. So they recommended a lesser level of discipline. They entered in a settlement agreement. He was reinstated pursuant to that.
Even though the controversy continues around these two guys, at some point, do you maybe just stop and like not reinstate people for a little bit? Just maybe.
Actually, the only ones we're stopping are the ones that went through civil service and were already adjudicated. These ones never made it to civil service. And
meanwhile, so the next day, four more come out. So
he's like, that's
four more that were only found because
respectfully, no, I refuse to chill.
He just like filed it already. He was like, wow.
Yeah, I cannot get enough of that clip because that is how I feel every time. More, do you ever just consider not doing all of the things that you're doing?
So he did an interview as part of his press tour this week with the LA Times with Matt Stiles. I don't know if you guys read this interview. It is really, really crazy. He says, based on my campaign promises, I'm going to carry them out one by one. I've telegraphed everything I was going to do from the beginning, so there should be no surprises, really. That is a targeted shot at me specifically for endorsing him. He talks about his adversarial relationship with the supervisors. He said, from the political side, because they are seasoned career politicians, it's up to them to guide the young guy coming into office. But they were actually lying in wait to attack him as soon as he showed up. Will not say what office Karen Mondian is working in and what capacity for his safety. He says he's just working in another assignment.
For his safety.
He says he's not on patrol.
For his safety.
The interviewer, Matt Stiles, asks, you anticipate him getting back pay when this case is settled? And Villanueva says, oh, he's going to be getting paid a lot more than back pay.
Wow.
He's gone through hell as an individual. His character was assassinated. So not just reinstating him, making sure that he's going to, I guess, get paid in his lawsuit against the county supervisor.
Yeah,
actually
sure.
Advocating that he should win that lawsuit.
He talks about the county council who is opposing the Mondian case, Mary Wickham, and how he said that she has gone rogue. Right. And the interviewer asked, what do you mean by that? And he said, she basically said that for all intents and purposes, she's in charge. I don't think the voters elected her as the sheriff. And then he says, we can't stamp out tattoos. We can't stamp out people wanting to join their own groups. That's solid First Amendment ground that we cannot touch.
Join their own groups.
Join their own groups is what I'm really into.
Join their own groups.
I wonder what his opinion is about criminal gangs, street gangs.
Well, that's interesting you bring that
their
up.
Their uniforms
Scott.
aren't nice enough.
Their tattoos are fine.
Related to gangs, I want to talk about something that actually happened last month that we never got to, but I think is an interesting new development and part of a new segment since we're rolling out new segments the last
left and right.
Couple episodes. I thought this could be a fun one where we basically take a term that is frequently used in coverage of the city and it's sort of unclear and try to explain what it means. A possible name for the segment is Term Down for What. If people don't like that, please speak up because there's a high risk of that being the name
That's really the only
segment.
Name I can think of.
That's my problem that I'm facing as well. And this is actually something that Nipsey Hussle cared a lot about. And so it's relevant to talk about this week. Much of the city of L.A. for the last 20 or so years has been under, actually back to 30 years, has been under what's called a gang injunction. What a gang injunction, it was a law enforcement policy designed to combat gang activity. First in South L.A., starting in, I believe, 2013, there was one imposed on the Echo Park, Silver Lake, Frogtown area. And it was policy designed to basically make it easier to arrest people who were gang affiliated. So this week, the judges have kind of been stripping away the LAPD's ability to impose these gang injunctions for the last several years. And last month in mid-March, a judge finally put sort of the final nail in the coffin of this policy and ruled in favor of the ACLU, made it illegal to impose these gang injunctions. What is a gang injunction? There's actually a video from 2009 where Nipsey Hussle talks about gang injunctions, and I think he explains what they are really well.
So it's certainly possible to be from a gang and not engage in criminal activity.
Most definitely. But I mean, some of the laws in California have been twisted to where just being from a gang is the crime. So, you know what I mean? If you're around your homies and your hood happen to be under an injunction, being around each other is a violation of you know what I'm saying, a law. So in some circumstances, they create laws to be something that beforehand wouldn't be illegal becomes illegal just because of your affiliation, like gang enhancements for your crimes.
Now, in 2003, your neighborhood was actually hit with an injunction. How did that affect people you know and the people that lived in that neighborhood?
I mean, it had an immediate effect on the people that was placed under that injunction, whose names was on it. And it made it to where, like I just said, like something that beforehand was perfectly legal became illegal just based on they filed a complaint. And, you know what I mean, now they got jurisdiction to take you to jail because you got a white T-shirt on or because you got a phone in your hand. Because you're hanging out with two people you grew up with your whole life. Now, at the same time, it is a violent history from all gangs in L.A., you know what I'm saying? But like we said before, we not the cause of that. We the effect, you know what I'm saying? We just adapted and took up a survival instinct, you know what I mean? So motherfuckers should have some type of consciousness of that when they create these laws and when they police our area.
So that explains what it is really well, specifically being able to be arrested because you're wearing a white T-shirt. That's not an exaggeration. That's real. In certain neighborhoods, if you wear a color that is affiliated with a certain gang, you were able to get arrested under these injunctions. If you were a former gang member and you still had a tattoo from your times being an active member.
Can't stop people from getting tattoos.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's sort of a one-sided approach to that.
The groups they join. But this is like the best explanation I have ever heard. Yes. Like I've never heard it explained so well as he just explained. It's coming from someone who's actually, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've heard this discussed so many times in like, you know, court rulings and city rulings and stuff, but like it really is about like letting people get on with their lives and live their lives, yes. You know,
and be able to hang out with people yeah. like that they have known their entire lives, yeah. including family members. Yeah. The person who was part of the case that the ACLU filed was a guy from Echo Park named Peter Arellano. He said he was never in a gang, but he was included in a gang injunction. Yeah. They just decide to put you on this list at some point. And so was his dad,
yeah.
meaning that he was not allowed to affiliate publicly with his right. dad. You aren't allowed to sit with someone. You're not allowed to like walk adjacent to them.
Not even publicly. It's also privately yeah. if you yes. are with yes. a certain number of people or whatever. Like it is, I think gang injunctions are, an incredibly sad hallmark of policing in the past 20 to 30 years. They're clearly just violate civil rights of individuals on a massive scale. And the intention seems to be, I think we've often talked about gang injunctions. I've had conversations with people personally about gang injunctions as being the violent implementation of gentrification and really functioning as a way to make life in certain neighborhoods so disruptive for right. people who live there that it becomes untenable for them to stay, or they go to jail and they return and no longer have any kind of community there.
Yeah. And in Echo Park, that did work to some extent.
Of course. Yeah.
And yeah. Echo Park's a like famous example.
Yes. And it was kind of treated as a way of, so for a while, people that used to be able to afford to live in Echo Park would come back on weekends to hang out with people that they still yeah. knew who lived there. And this was seen as a way to just flush people out of the neighborhood entirely, because just for affiliating with their friends, they could be arrested and go to jail.
Like literally, if we were looking at the Echo Park gang injunction last year. I don't think it actually made it into the show at any point, but we were looking at the actual text of the document, and it was things like what Nipsey's talking about in the video. It was things including if a person who was either named or affiliated with a named person under the gang injunction was staring at somebody yeah. who was not named under mm-hmm. the injunction. So basically, you can let your imagination run wild if you are, particularly if you have ever been policed as a person of color in LA or America at all. Anybody's perception of you living in this neighborhood or any neighborhood covered by a gang injunction made you extraordinarily vulnerable to police violence, to arrest, to criminal charges of a wide variety. So it's a very sad part of LA's recent history. Yeah. And I'm glad that they are now fully no longer implementable.
Yeah, thanks to the ACLU going to federal court over it. There are apparently a handful of people who are still left under these gang injunctions from a peak of 9,000 people who were on the list.
Wow.
And last year there was a big purge of the list, but there were still 1,500 people left on it. And now, well, I don't know what a handful is.
This episode is like brought to you by the ACLU.
Right. And that's it for this week. Thank you again for listening. We will be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye-bye.